Wildfires, rainstorms, extreme heat we're seeing in southern Wisconsin today. It's been another summer across the state, and climate scientists tell us to expect more of the same. But how many of us understand the causes and results of some of the climate change we've seen? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show. And joining us for the next hour, our weather guys. John Martin is a professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. And Steve Ackerman is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And we want to invite you to the conversation. Questions about Wisconsin weather, trends, phenomenon. What questions do you have for them? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email, talk@WPR.org. That's 800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. And John and Steve, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
It's Thanks. Great to be back
Great to
here.
Be here.
Yeah.
Let's start with the heat today. Our heat indices could reach 104 degrees across southern Wisconsin. That's expected to last until at least 8 tonight. But what am I to make of these heat advisories and what they mean for me?
It means you got to be careful if you're outside, especially inactive. And if you're in a place without air conditioning, without good ventilation, you can run the risk of getting so much water retained in your body on days like this that you cannot cool yourself down by perspiration and get overheated. And yeah. Is it hypothermia or the other way?
Yeah.
Is it hypothermia when you get overheated or is it hyperthermia? I forget which one's which.
Hypo is the cold one.
Okay, so hyperthermia.
Sleeping bags.
Yeah, you got to be really careful on days like this.
Yeah, drink water if you're outside.
Yeah.
So take those advisories seriously. They're nothing to
sneeze at.
No, those advisories are being issued by the government, by the National Weather Service, and that they take that very, very serious with high integrity.
I know some people that take it as a challenge. All right, time to do yard work, but that's not a good idea.
Find the shade at a minimum. If you just can't put it off, find the shade.
Time to find a pool.
There you go. It's critical.
It's an excuse to not do the yard work and not
exert to
yourself.
My house, Lee. I'll tell you that right now. Why don't you go and trim that tree? Well, then I'll lose the shade.
I've got an advisory. Exactly. Let's go to Elizabeth in La Crosse, who has a question for you guys. Elizabeth, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
I was wondering what specific or immediate impacts we're seeing with the elimination of NOAA's Office of Oceanic and Atmospheric Research, the cuts to climate research, cooperative institutes, and staffing levels, what we're seeing in regards to these severe weather forecasting, long-term climate monitoring, and public safety in the U.S.
I believe it was April when the Trump administration dismissed experts who were working on the next climate assessment, pulled down the website for it, and removed the phrase climate science from government websites. I also know you guys have a recent article on the National Climate Assessment that was released a couple years ago now. So what do these cuts mean as you guys see it? And I want to ask both of you, and Steve, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think it's really a shame. Because it is going to impact our forecasting. One of the things we rely on in forecasting, particularly as we get into the fall and the wintertime, is knowing what the upper air is doing and knowing it accurately. And because of the cuts, some of the stations, I think it was in Nebraska, are reducing the amount of weather balloons that they launch in order to make those measurements so we can identify where the jet stream is flowing. And now it may be hard to see what that impact is only because we don't have enough data yet. It takes data, collection of data, to really see what the impacts are going to be in the long run.
Or a loss of that data.
Or a loss of that data, right. And a long series so you can compare, what's happening in the last couple of months to what's happening prior to eliminating those radio sounds, as an example. And the same thing with the climate. It's just, it's important for us to monitor what is going on. And to pretend that climate change isn't happening is just no scientific integrity there, I don't think.
Yeah.
John, what about the question of federal funding for NOAA and weather stations and what that means for us?
Yeah, I think it's a long fuse problem. It's one of the things that this administration is pretty good at, is picking at things that will take a long time to have an impact. And by the time people actually are impacted by some of these changes, they may forget what was the origin of this impact that they're currently experiencing. And, you know, it's going to take a long time, maybe a couple of years, before systematic reduction in the observational capability that Steve was just talking about is going to have an impact on the way that we can foretell what's coming in the weather. If I were a property owner on the east coast of Florida, let's say I owned a giant mansion that I bought for some reduced price by some way right near West Palm Beach, I would not want to have taken the Defense Meteorological Satellites out of service this summer, because they are the only thing that can look into hurricanes with any sort of ability to tell what's going on inside the storm overnight. A whole fleet of observations for overnight forecasting of hurricane intensification is now gone. And there's no reason for that. There was no motivation for that other than we can do it, we're going to do it, it's going to make a bunch of people mad who work at universities. That's why they did it. And it's going to cost people lives.
The argument is government efficiency, I believe, but you would argue that that is, in the long run, an inefficient way to operate a government.
What's your definition of efficiency? Do you want to deliver the best product at the best amount of time with the best lead time? That's how I would define efficiency. All of these changes will do absolutely the opposite in all three of those categories of that definition.
Yeah, that's a good definition of efficiency. Yeah. Right?
So
doing it right.
What if we decide that we want this federal funding to return? If we want a fully funding NOAA and we want these weather stations back in action, is that something that can flip a switch, or is that something that would be an inefficient thing to restart?
I think it would be hard to reset, because you lost a number of people who are already trained.
That's the key.
And not just trained, because we do the training here at the university as well, but have the experience to know how to apply that knowledge that they'll get from the classroom.
Yeah. Expert judgment takes years of practice to develop. And when you forsake it and you get rid of it willy-nilly, it takes a whole generation to reinstitute that expert knowledge. And there's not going to be any handoff of it from this current generation that's all been dismissed to the latest young people who are coming into the field with advanced knowledge of new techniques. It'd be a perfect, it's been a time-honored way of doing it. You give the advice and experience of the prior generation to a bunch of kids with new tools.
Right.
That's how you make progress.
And that sounds like it could be stopped.
It's going to be curtailed at a minimum.
Yeah. In a follow-up email, Fred emailed here to ask what you guys think of the Trump's Environmental Protection Agency's plan to end greenhouse gas regulations and the role that could play in our climate. Steve?
Well, we know that's one of the issues we're dealing with climate change is the amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere. And so to stop monitoring that, to stop caring about that, well, that's just saying we don't care about climate. We don't care about the people who live in Florida who are sitting on the coastline and need to know what's going to happen with hurricanes, or up here as well. What's going to happen if we don't have winters?
Right. This is an example of one of many examples of the clown show nature of the administration when it comes to these kinds of issues. It's like taking the worst behaved kid in the sixth grade class and making him or her the monitor of behavior for students in the class. You don't do that. You take the advice of experts on problems like this. You don't decide just again because you can that you're going to stop paying attention to something that every expert in the world will testify to the fact that it's causing problems. And those problems will multiply in the future if we don't get a hold on them now.
And I want to ask you a little bit about that. When we flip the switch on climate change and say we're not going to post it, we're not going to talk about it, we're not going to look into it, what is the real world ramifications of that? Maybe we feel better about our climate because we're not told all the doom and gloom that it's getting worse and there are ways to make it better that we are choosing not to take. Take us down the road where this persists and this is the world we live in. And what does this world look like in my daily life?
Yeah, I think in a daily life, because we're talking about climate, you may not notice anything. The question is, what is it going to be like 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And if we don't collect that data, we will not know what is being changed. My guess is if we're not going to be monitoring greenhouse gases, that it's going to get worse, right? Because
more greenhouse gases,
we're going to have more warming, and that's going to warm the climate even more.
Yeah, there's no surprise about the physical result of it, but I think there's also a psychic and sociological result of these kinds of willy-nilly cuts and dismissing of really important challenges that we all face. Steve and I are of the generation, I think, that was brought up watching the Apollo program
mature
into something that was just fantastically
exciting. Science continued to expand who we were as a people, as a human race, and the world that we lived in continued to get bigger and greater. That science was taking us somewhere.
That's
we were going somewhere with our understanding and using the scientific method to test out our world.
Right. And in addition to all those things that are tangible results of it, there's an inspirational quality to that exploration and to that reliance on learning and science and experts that you really, if you aren't careful, you dismantle that whole psychic structure. And young people growing up today, first through fifth through seventh and eighth grade, are going to be less than challenged because they're being told there's no problems. And so I don't think that's good for our culture.
Yeah. That they don't have to worry about it because they don't see it because we stop publishing it and stop looking into it.
It's not something
therefore,
you should think about.
It does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Little more practical back here at home happening right now. Mandy in Viroqua called, couldn't stay with us. She heard a derecho warning was issued today and is wondering about the implications for Wisconsin. First of all, what's a derecho warning?
A derecho is a kind of storm that's it's reminiscent of the kind that can develop tornadoes, but these are straight line winds. And I think I heard about this. This is going to be like 100 mile per hour wind forecasts in parts of South Dakota and Minnesota. Later today, so in the afternoon, it appears as though in the forecast, the feature that's controlling that that threat is going to dissipate rather rapidly late in the evening, and so it won't have a big impact on much of the state. I suppose the far southwestern and western parts of the state might feel something from it, but probably not in its most robust state. That's at least the current forecast.
And with regard to the warning part or the watch part, when we're looking at severe weather. NOAA, National Weather Service, if it looks like it might happen, then they'll issue a watch. They're basically saying, watch out for this. When they're issuing a warning, then that means either it's occurring and heading your way.
So watch is a heads up, and warning is get your head down.
Get your heads down. Just a 100-mile-per-hour wind. Get indoors, I guess.
And make sure it's bolted. It'll strip paint off the side of barns, that kind of wind. That's what it'll do.
Jim in the town of Middleton is emailed to say, it seems that some weather systems coming from the southwest have a localized split that goes around areas to the northeast, such as Pine Bluff or the town of Middleton. Is there any meteorological data that would support what he calls a Blue Mounds effect, where a weather system hits something and goes two separate ways? I kind of feel this way sometimes about weather. It feels like it just missed us somehow, or is that just the way it feels?
You know, I'm trying to think. I remember hearing about this, and it was, I don't know if it was in Blue Mounds or where it was, about the weather systems always going around that area. I've never seen the data to support that.
Okay.
But, you know, people who live there who either want the data, weather data or don't want it, probably will draw that conclusion.
Yeah, it's a plausible explanation for a repeated observation, if it's repeated.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes we have a tendency to kind of exaggerate the repetition. But if it is always happening, that's a plausible explanation. Although I agree with Steve, I've seen no, you know, systematic study that's come to that conclusion about the topography here in the southwest part of our state.
There's your scientific method right there.
Two
scientists going through it trying to figure out.
Data, you can probably take a look at that.
Yeah, so you could do the work to figure it out.
Yeah, at least if the systems are precipitating anyway.
Yeah.
John Martin, Steve Ackerman, the weather guys are with us today, and we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What have you seen from Wisconsin's summer weather so far, and what questions do you have about what to expect next, or some phenomenon that you'd like to know more about? Call us, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have not signed up for WPR's new daily newsletter yet, do not wait. Curated by our own Jenny Peake, you'll never miss the day's top stories, must-listen audio segments and interviews, exclusive feature photos, behind-the-scenes conversations with our reporters, and you get it all in your inbox once a day. So sign up right now before you forget. WPR.org/newsletters. That's WPR.org/newsletters, and stay informed and connected through WPR. Our guest, Steve Ackerman, Emeritus Professor at UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and John Martin here as well, the weather guys. John's a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and we're taking your calls and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Ed in Madison next. Ed, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I know my question is not exactly a meteorological question, but I am concerned about human survival in this climate change. Someday we may be in a real tough situation because it doesn't look too well that we're going to keep addressing this concern, especially with the Luddites that are in power. So I was just wondering what you think of carbon capture technology. Does that offer a realistic solution, or at least a significant help in trying to stop this climate change?
Ed, thank you for the question, and I'm not sure our guests right now are the best to answer it, but Steve, I'll ask you what you understand about carbon capture and what it might do.
Yeah, the question that I always have, and again, I'm not an expert in it, is right. That once you capture that, what are you going to do with it, right? Because if you want to keep it from getting into the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas, then, you know, having trees, for example, more trees, which is a great thing, and they suck up carbon dioxide in their photosynthesis processes. But once they die, that carbon dioxide then goes back. So I think it's important to look at, in addition to looking at how do we not put as much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That seems like something we could more easily control. And I think, you know, the climate's going to get really hot and warm and unbearable in some places. But I don't think it's going to threaten the human survival because we do live extreme climates right now in terms of really hot deserts or really cold polar regions.
Yeah, I appreciate the perspective, Ed. But, John, is carbon capture or carbon prevention our best method going forward if that were a concern?
I wish I were expert. I'm going to have to preface anything I say by reminding everybody that I'm not. But I wouldn't guess anything's really our best bet. And we got to use every tool available. And so I would guess that carbon capture, as it continues to mature, is going to be a pretty powerful weapon that we can use. But it'll only be it'll reach its greatest effect only in conjunction with other efforts. So I'm hoping for the best on that, and I think it will contribute to an alleviation of the problem, but it won't get over the fact that we're ignoring it, by and large, right now. But that ignorance is temporary. I think that it's just not going to last. It won't win the day. The question is, and the frustration is, you know, as 3 years tick by, how much more do we have to do to get ourselves out of the hole that we dug for three more years that we didn't need to be digging?
So. I feel like science has reached some sort of PR catastrophe that nobody's spoken up for science for so long, or it's been so ubiquitous in what we've come to expect in our quality of life that nobody's actually stopped to say, hey, this scientific method is very important, and if we turn our back on it, we don't know where we're going.
Yeah, I think that, Lee, is a symptom of a broader problem, which is a disrespect for expertise, no matter where it is. Expertise in anything. You know, my local mail person is better at figuring out how to get that stuff done than I could be.
You know how complicated a toilet is? I do not know
yes,
how complicated a toilet
exactly
is. And that
right.
could be trouble for me if I didn't have a toilet expert that I could call in.
That's precisely what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I know we're both in earnest, and we have a completely begun to have a great erosion of respect for expertise, and it leads to some critical problems, and we got to get over it.
So how do we, you know, I feel like I just need to advocate for science and what science mm-hmm. has done and how science is used not to prove something, but to disprove things and find better ways. It feels like we're feeling our way through the darkness, but getting there.
Yeah.
And then when we drop the scientific method, it just feels like we're feeling around in the darkness, and somebody needs to speak up for that.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with that.
And I think shows like this do that.
Me too.
Trying.
You know,
trying.
Trying. I mean,
so, and bringing in experts.
Pretty scientific expertise prior to us.
You're right. That there is this entire world out there that experts understand and can explain and show you sort of a window into it. And if you saw that, you could see where we're going. And that is an exciting way to live.
It is. Yeah. It is.
But
it,
you turn that light out and all of a sudden you don't know where we are, where we're going, and it
right.
feels...
And, you know, underlying that understanding is decades of hard work by each of those individual scientists. Nobody's born understanding anything. And if you become an expert in something, that's testament to the fact that you've worked hard to become an expert at something, and you ought to be part of the conversation.
Well, I appreciate that perspective. Let's go to Dave in Oconto County next. Dave, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. With the budget cuts affecting the use of our satellites in monitoring the space and the atmosphere of the Earth, and also looking at the position of the elliptical position of the North Pole, which right now we are in the decline of that elliptical position, which brings the North Pole closer to the sun, which creates a warmer global warming atmosphere, which then also is affecting the natural part of the Earth, creating the methane gases, along with human inhabitants who adds more to it. So with the budget cuts, we won't have that ability to monitor where the position of the Earth's axis really sit. Is there any discussion on that lately?
Boy, I have not. I mean, you're right. That's one of the variations of with regard to natural climate change, what I call natural, in the sense of how Earth orbits the sun. And sometimes it changes so it's further away. And as you're pointing out, sometimes it's pointing at a different angle. And that is important to know what those natural changes are in order to really confirm what the human impacts are and what we're doing. That goes beyond what the natural variations will be. And, yeah, I mean, I think that the cuts that they're having in the weather satellites are certainly affecting and will continue to affect our ability to do weather forecasting.
Yeah, and here's where, you know, the timescales of some of these processes are being very different from one another. The precession of the inclination of the Earth is on hundreds of thousands of years timescale, so it's not something we have to worry about for tomorrow. So... though that's never an argument for not observing things, it won't be an impactful lack of observation on that particular issue. But on many other ones, of course, it will be.
Yeah. Dave, I appreciate the call. We'll go next to Jeff, who has a house on a Madison Lake. Jeff, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. My family has had a home on Lake Mendota since, like, 1900 on the west side. And this observation over all the years that we've seen countless storms. They'll come in from the west, and they always go around the north side of the lake or the south side of the lake. You know, we always think of, you mentioned earlier about the blue mound effect,
yeah.
But we wonder if it's not the lakes. It's very, very rare, but once in a while, the storms will go around the north side of the lake and then come back from the east. And those are the worst storms that we've seen.
Huh.
So, you know, we really support, you know, the work of NOAA and the climate scientists. And yeah, we're just pretty appalled at what's all going on.
So are these thunderstorms that I live on the north end of the lake. and so, you know, so what you're so I'm in the area where we would get a lot of rain, and I'm happy to get that rain as long as it doesn't flood. so are they thunderstorms that you think that go through the north end and then circle around and hit the area from the east?
Yeah, well, it's like I said, we've only seen like once in a really great while. But does it, I mean, once every 10 or 20 years, kind of a thing like that. But
yeah.
otherwise, the storms, we always see them. Like I say, you can hear them rumbling coming in from the west, but then they always go to the north side of the lake or to the south side of the lake. But we rarely have had, you know, a big storm hit us that we're over by Spring Harbor and that part of the area is where our family's home is there. So,
yeah.
Well, the lakes during the summertime, the water temperature is almost always cooler than the land temperature around the lake. So like on a day like today's another example. And that will set up a small scale and probably most of the time ineffective lake breeze around the whole shore. And that is going to produce a region of low-level divergence over the lake, which is exactly the opposite kind of wind field that the storm wants to you know, that's going to survive on. But my guess is that most of the storms are pretty well developed and have their own internal circulations that overwhelm that weak lake breeze that probably develops. So I bet it has a smaller impact than you think. However, if a storm is just beginning to develop, let's say in Middleton or in Cross Plains, maybe it doesn't have a strong enough internal circulation to overcome some bias that the lake can impose. And that might be part of what the observations say. And then the last thing I was thinking in your comments was those ones that come back from the east, I wonder if there was a way to, you know, they're really rare, but I wonder if it's that the lake breeze from Lake Michigan on the perfect kind of day has made its way so far west that it actually can push disturbances a little bit back to the east upon them encountering it. I don't know if that's true or not. I think sometimes a lake breeze can extend that far, but the conditions are very precise for that to happen. But that would account for the rarity.
Yeah. The so-called Blue Mounds effect appears to be the theme for the day. Dan emailed with a question about weather systems splitting or going around certain areas. He's heard stories of storms dissipating when they reach the Anago area because of the silt loam soil. Could soil in certain areas affect the weather? I've also seen stories in the last couple of weeks about corn sweat and what corn sweat could do to weather.
So corn sweat, I could see it for sure because there's so much of it. But again, it's going to be in a larger scale because what the corn sweat is doing is putting water vapor into the atmosphere that then the storms can tap into and precipitate out. The soil, again, I think would be, where in my mind, where soil really has an impact is when there's no vegetation on it. Because then you're going to get the big temperature differences, the really hot land and the cooler atmosphere that would support convection. But if it's, you know, got vegetation on it, I'm not sure that it would have that much of an effect.
No, and if it's saturated, let's say it had a rain the day before, it might act like a cornfield in mid-July because then it's got a lot of evaporation coming out of it. It's kind of what you were thinking about on the other side of the coin. So that's, without knowing more details, that's hard to know. But these things, it's interesting that summertime weather systems really can respond to some of these local, vegetation slash water on the ground slash dry ground aspects.
And this is why, personally, in the summertime, if I want to go outside and work in the garden or do something, and I look up and it's cloudy or I hear thunder, I'm on that radar app. And looking.
Absolutely.
Where is it? What's coming? And is it dissipating or intensifying?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times it'll be raining all around, but not at our house. And when you look at the radar, you can say, it's just the process that entire storm has been developing.
And it's amazing now how prevalent a time series of fundamental observations is to people's daily lives. What it is. When you watch your radar animation, it's a time series of fundamental
to find out,
obs.
To get the surrounding area, find out where you're in the thick of it or where the thick of it is. To think of the anecdotal, what I see in the skies and how does this play into the, is the soil shifting the weather? Is the lake shifting it? And then to get down to such a fine point in our forecasting, when did we get so good at weather forecasting that you've got a 7-day forecast that you could believe or rely on?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
That's been a slow, evolving, silent revolution.
Oh, my gosh.
And I would say that I always preface it this way. If you can paint the complexion of the day 7 days out fairly accurately most of the time, that's a good forecast. You're not going to get a point-specific accurate forecast. It's going to rain today at 2 o'clock or next Sunday, 2 o'clock. And so if you have that expectation, it's not reasonable. But that's probably evolved since I've been here. I don't think when I came here in 1994, we could actually say that. We were thinking about 3 and 5 days as sort of the frontier. Now 7 to 10 is the frontier. So that's been within the last 3 decades.
I remember a local weatherman in Madison who would have +/-4 degrees for his forecast for the next day. Yeah. And now that was like a contest. If they got it wrong, they'd give out umbrellas.
Right. But that's right.
Now you just expect it every day within 4 degrees.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. Oh. And to think about how we easily take it, I'm not blaming anybody, but we take
don't
that
even think
for
about
granted.
It. And it's too easy.
All of our grandparents and many people's grandparents do not have that aspect of their lives at all.
Yeah. And the bigger picture of what that could mean for what that does mean for transportation, for agriculture, for business, it's mind-boggling.
It is. It is.
Yeah, I do this talk, John knows, about the Edmund Fitzgerald, which went down in 1975. And the comparisons I make is that in 1940, we had the big Armistice Day storm, and that killed over 60 people because they had no idea it was coming. Yeah. In 75, they knew it was coming, but the forecast wasn't as accurate as it needed to be when they made their adjustment to their ship, and then all 29 people died on it. Mm. In 1998, almost exactly the same yeah. storm as 1975 and 1940. And the National Weather Service forecasted it right. Nobody died.
Yes, right on the money. Days in advance.
So not just transportation and agriculture, but lives.
Right.
Life
yeah.
and death.
Yeah. yeah.
Oh, something to think about.
It is.
Let's go to Randy and Ripon next. Randy, good afternoon. You're on the air with the Weather Guys.
Hi. Back when we had 9/11, public radio had a guest on talking about, because they had grounded all commercial flights, and they had a guest on talking about the measurement of sunlight hitting the planet and how there was a spike after that, whatever it was, a week or whatever, several days in the amount of sunlight hitting. And I've often wondered, because here in Ripon, there's a flight path from Milwaukee to Minneapolis, and I always see the contrails leaving shadows across the ground. And I'm just wondering, is that still a factor? Because this guest had said they thought the global temperatures would be about 2 degrees warmer if it wasn't for that shape.
I seem to remember something about the jet airstreams, the contrails clearing the skies after September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, I remember that too. And I don't remember. I'll have to go back and look this up. But if I remember, was it associated with the cloudiness going down? Because, yeah, with no airplanes allowed to fly over the U.S., you're not going to get those contrails, and that increases cloudiness. Or if it was surface temperatures, because when you have contrails up there, they can reflect solar energy, but they also emit infrared radiation down to the surface. Mm. And so thin cirrus clouds tend to warm the planet, not cool it, as opposed to thick stratocumulus clouds, low-level clouds, which will cool the planet, not warm it. Mm. So I remember there was that study. I just don't remember what the results were.
Me too. I'm equally vague on that. Some of the details. One of them was, I thought it was somebody in the UW system, UW Pock Falls UW
right.
River Falls.
His name. All of a sudden, yeah. yell at his
it's
name.
Right there on the tip of your tongue.
And I thought that the result was that overnight lows were a little bit lower, but the daytime highs, there was no significant change over that short period of time.
Yeah, so. I think that's what. Yeah, well, he was at Whitewater.
Whitewater. That's it. Yeah.
Great question, Randy, and thank you for that. Speaking of overnight lows, Libby emailed. She has an above ground pool heated by a solar blanket. She says that it seems as early as August, the water doesn't get that warm, and she thinks it cools off so much more at night. Is it traditionally much cooler at night in August than June or July, or is she wrong about her solar blanket on her pool?
She's not wrong.
Really?
When you get to August 21st, you have the same length of day as you had on April 21st. So you have longer night, and that makes a difference. Absolutely right. And you don't see it so much in early July. I bet you she'd see it right now in late July, but not so much in early July. You're right around the solstice. But by the time you get to August, no doubt. And in addition, probably slightly drier air so that the radiation is able to get out of the atmosphere a little bit better than it was in July or late June. So there's a couple of things working against you there.
Wow, interesting. I never would have thought
that.
Yeah. Well, when you think about it.
That's a heck of an observation she's making, too.
Yeah. Right on that. Yeah.
Libby, way to go. And I really appreciate the email and way to think it through with your pool. I appreciate that. We had three tornadoes reported touching down, according to the National Weather Service in Green Bay, last Wednesday. The Wausau ABC affiliate weather says that they have, Wisconsin has had 33 tornadoes so far in 2025. They say that it's normal to see about 23 for the entire year. And yet it doesn't seem like it's been that unstable for tornadoes this season. I'm wondering what you guys have seen in terms of severe weather.
So, I was surprised that we have 33 already tornadoes. So we did have one in February, too, for the first time. So that might be part of it as well. But, I think I don't. It would be interesting to know what the distribution is. You know, are the F0s the really weakest ones?
Hmm.
I don't think we've had any F5s or F4s.
They tend to make pretty widespread news when they're that kind of devastation. Yeah. Yeah, but you know, I think it's, and the other thing for us down the southern part of the state is that there've been more in the northern part of the state. I would guess.
Yeah.
Splitting the state in those halves, I would guess 2/3 or more of them have been in the northern half of the state.
Okay.
Not so much here.
Was the February tornado this year or last year?
Might have been last year.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was last year or this year.
But is tornado season not what it used to be?
I don't think I'd be ready to draw that conclusion.
Okay.
I don't think that's the case at all. It's shifted a little bit. Tornado Alley shifted a little bit to the east. Recent research out of Northern Illinois University in Oklahoma has kind of said that. But the number of storms, I don't think, has changed substantially. The number of most intense ones hasn't changed substantially. So I don't think so. Nationwide, anyway. Statewide might be different.
What have we seen in this year's hurricane season? I thought we were expecting... I would just ask you your expectations of this hurricane season and what we've seen so far.
I think we had two named storms, I think. We got up to the letter B,
right?
Maybe. And they haven't been particularly impactful. That doesn't mean they weren't strong. I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
They could stay
just
off
land.
Yeah. If they don't hit land, we don't have such a focus on them. But honestly, by the end of July, that's not usually a time where you've really seen any substantial hurricane activity in the Atlantic Basin. It starts to rev up now, right at the end of the month, early August, mid-August, particularly mid-August to the end of September is the time to be really concerned. So far, it's behaved like a normal season, I would say.
That's John Martin, professor and former chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Also joining us, the other half of the weather guy, Steve Ackerman, emeritus professor at UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Want to invite you to our weather conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, the new book, Piracy on the Great Lakes. We'll learn about the buccaneers of our inland seas, then talk about the planned city of Greendale, and we'll be joined by the editor of Lake Superior Magazine, all tomorrow from 11 to 1 on The Larry Mueller Show here on WPR News. But right now, we have the weather guys joining us. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are here to answer your questions for the remainder of the hour, but you're going to want to get them in quick, so give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. Got another email here, and this seems to be the theme of our day, watching weather systems divide and what may be causing that. Mark emailed to share another geographic feature affecting the weather, the Niagara Escarpment, which he says causes westward-heading weather systems to split at Lake Poygan, causing two systems that go north and south, which misses the eastern shore of Lake Winneconne. You know anything about this, Steve?
No, I don't. But you know, now we're talking about geographic features that are bigger.
Niagara.
The escarpment's huge. It goes on forever.
Right. Yeah. And so when you start getting large things, you know, like certainly the Rocky Mountains impact storms as well.
Yeah.
But again, I think it would take that study to look. And it also would depend on the storms. I can't imagine a big mid-latitude storm in November or December really caring about what the terrain is.
Rides roughshod over all of it. But in the summertime, maybe the direction of the flow at certain levels can really have some impact on generation or sustenance of those storms.
Yeah. Kick it off.
You know, kick it off. Yeah, initiation even. Yeah. Yeah.
It certainly feels like something that would deserve to be explored a little more, considering how many anecdotal stories we've heard about it and how many different places claim to actually impact the weather, even though, as you both point out, the weather system's usually going to be the stronger of the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's great that people are paying attention.
I know. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Everybody loves the weather.
It's hard not to.
Well, you know, the funny thing to me is it's Wisconsin, and it's the one thing we like talking about. We love talking about the weather. To me, it's the kindness, because it's a common ground we all share.
Yeah.
So if we want to find common ground among even strangers on the streets in Wisconsin, we can always fall back on the weather, because it's a thing that we share together, and it's a nice starting point.
Yeah.
And
very
it varies
true.
Throughout the year.
Yeah,
too.
It does.
And it's
always
interesting.
Yeah, there's nothing more interesting.
Of course, that's according to John Martin.
Martin
now.
The weather guy.
We learned last week that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's weather radio radios weren't working in parts of western Wisconsin. Last Wednesday, service from the weather transmitter located in Wheeler was restored. But how serious is it? Is a problem when the weather radios start malfunctioning?
I think in some rural areas, yeah, it's really important because, well, anyway, they rely on that to tell is severe weather coming. You know, where the warnings are going to be issued, where the watches are going to be issued, they're coming across on that weather radio. So if there's a large geographic or even a small geographic, anybody who depends on that to know if severe weather is coming, it's not a good thing.
No, it's not. I mean, this wasn't the case in the Texas flood, the tragedy that happened a couple of weeks ago. There were warnings going out on the NOAA radios. They just weren't widespread in use.
Right.
And so
yeah,
people weren't receiving that news that was being offered free for, you know, from the government. So they're a big deal. You got to get that fixed.
Well, and I interviewed the director of the Outagamie County Emergency Management, and they give those weather radios out as part of their weather alert system.
Yeah.
And yeah, it wasn't out that long, right? I mean, it wasn't like they were
a few days, I think. Yeah. Would you recommend getting a weather radio? If you get the alerts on your phone, is a weather radio...
The weather radio will wake you up in the middle of the night. Your phone might not do that. So, I mean, right, if I'm really, let's say I have some interest or some particular fear of such storms, I would definitely get one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike in Dunn County, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was recently at a baseball game for one of my grandkids, and there was a storm approaching. It was hot and humid. And I thought, I think they should get the kids off the field. And they said, oh, no, we don't have to because the lightning's not coming straight down. If it's that would be worse, but if it goes across the sky, we should be safe. So I just want to know what's your attitude on that, and I'll take an answer up there.
Mike, I'm telling you, it does not look good in the studio right now by the expressions
lightning
of our weather
lightning
guys.
Yeah. And if you hear lightning, you should not be on a baseball field.
Yeah, my kids played in West Madison for years here in town, great league, and I coached for a number of years. I was amazed at how good everybody got at reading the radar, and the other thing was really important. As soon as thunder was heard, umpires take everybody off the field. 30 minutes transpire. If we don't hear any more thunder in that 30 minutes, we can take the field again. That's the only threshold. So you got to get off the field when you hear thunder.
So
no questions asked.
Lightning sideways is just as dangerous or deadly than lightning up and down.
Lightning sideways may turn your day sideways. So you got to get off the field. Yep.
And is that just how the electron charge interacts with the spark? What decides where the lightning goes?
Hmm. It's pretty much up to the lightning into the atmosphere. So they'll set up a channel, and that's what the lightning will follow. When it's hitting land, the land surface, whether it's a tree or a building, is helping to set up what that channel is.
Okay.
But you can get cloud-to-cloud lightning as well, and that's when you're getting that horizontal one. So it's traveling from one part of a cloud to another.
But a storm doesn't have a preference whether it connects to the cloud or the ground. It's just looking for that connection.
It's following that channel. It's got a lot of charge, and it's trying to get rid of it.
And there's no observation you can make that can lead you to conclude that you've correctly assessed that it's not going to drop it to the ground.
That's not the lightning that'll get us. Any lightning can get you.
Yeah.
You two recently wrote a column about how rainfall intensity is changing. Is that anecdotal? Is that real?
No, that was real. That was a question that somebody, we do on a column for the paper as well, and somebody wrote and asked about that. It was very interesting, I thought, because I didn't know. But is it, rainfall's going up, but is it going up just in the mean? Or are we getting more small events?
Yeah.
Are we getting more larger events? And it turns out we're getting less events that have more rain in them. Which is really interesting because it's telling you that the storm dynamics are changing.
It's not just
about the water vapor in the atmosphere, which is what I was typically thinking of.
Yeah, can I just tell a short story about this? Steve, we received these notes from people together. You got particularly interested in this, and at first, he was thinking just what you said.
Right.
And then he said, let me look at this again. So this percolated for a couple of weeks before it showed up in the article you wrote, and it was really excellent work. I remember I could tell you were on the trail of this.
Really
you were really into that.
You know, it's like here. You get a lot of interesting people making their own observations and then wondering. You know?
Yeah,
so I'm going to start looking at the radar and see if it's going around the lake.
Yeah, right.
So the rainfall then, it is happening. It is more intense, but it's happening in shorter bursts?
I wouldn't say shorter, but it's coming in heavier events. So when it rains, so what they did was they looked at two 20-year periods, and the last one, I think, ended in 2014 or something like that, in the mid-20s, because that's when the data was good. And then they broke it up into light rain, moderate rain, and heavy rain, because that's how we typically categorize it. And what they found was there were less cases of light rain and more cases of heavy rain.
Does this change what we would do in terms of flood mitigation, do you think? Or how we'd plan for 100-year floods?
I would think so, because if you have light rain, heavy rain is, of course, the urban flooding in general.
Right, yeah, city engineers would pay attention to that in a lot of places. Yeah, if you're getting more frequent heavy events, the kind that already your system struggles with, you're going to have to make some adjustments to your system if they're going to become more numerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to try a weather term on you guys, see if you can spell it out for me. Mesoscale convective complex. What's a mesoscale convective complex?
I'll take the last C. It's a complex of storms.
Yeah, they're smaller scale, so they're the scale of a state in the United States.
Okay.
Smaller scale than what we get for wintertime cyclones, the kind that can deliver, you know, precipitation over 10 states at once. But they're a summertime phenomena usually, and they're a collection of thunderstorms that in their organization, they create a circulation amongst themselves, not just individually. And so they're
storm of storms?
Yeah, and they become a long-lived entity. They can sometimes live for two straight days, and they don't move very much. So when you get an MCC, a mesoscale convective complex, over you, and it's a non-translational one, which is some large fraction of the total of such events, it'll stay over the state of Missouri for 36 hours, and places will just get inundated for that period of time. So they're really interesting phenomena, and they're a summertime phenomena in the central plains of the United States.
How common are they?
I'd say you get through a couple every single summer, I would say.
But I don't necessarily hear it or see it on my app as a mesoscale convective complex.
Yeah, probably not. They're just going to see, you know, you might notice that you get three straight days of moderate to heavy rain or something like that. And you say, what's going on with that? Well, you're underneath one of these probably.
Let's see if we can fit one more question in quick here. Martin from Middleton, good afternoon.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for getting me in. Is there such a thing as a micro tornado? Twice now, in the Madison area, I've seen these little corkscrew things. It looks like a pig's tail hanging down from a cloud high up in the sky. It moves a little bit, and I've watched them for a couple of minutes, and then they disappear.
I don't doubt it. I think one of the elements in the larger tornadic funnels that develop is something called suction vortices. They're much smaller scale, and something goes on in those storms that organizes a collection of those suction vortices and creates one larger funnel. So what you're seeing, I think, is an aborted tornado formation. You've got a couple of little suction vortices that are coming out of the clouds, but there's not enough, whatever the extra ingredient is. I'm not an expert on this. Whatever that extra ingredient is to organize or maybe amplify those first few vortices.
So you wouldn't call it a micro tornado. You'd call it a start of a tornado.
Yeah. They have a formal name called suction vortices, and they are elements of the origin of the bigger funnels. Yeah.
And it can only be a tornado if it touches ground.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's the other thing.
Technically, it's not a tornado.
So what is it before it touches ground or if it doesn't?
It could be a vortex or a funnel cloud. So sometimes you'll see a funnel hang down from a cloud, and that's, as John's pointing out, it's just another. The circulation wants to develop a tornado, but it may not get down to the surface and start destruction.
That's an important distinction,
Guys, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for yours and your expertise as always. Really enjoy the perspective, and I want to thank all the callers from calling in because they seem to find a central theme that we grab onto, and today was weather systems splitting in half.
Yeah, we're going to be watching that radar.
Who knows what reason, and maybe there is research to be done to learn a thing or two in the days, years ahead. Thank you both for joining us today. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Joel.
Steve Ackerman is a former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison and emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin is a professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Thanks to them and thanks to you for joining us today as well. It's a product of our team, the Larry Mueller team here, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Thanks to them all, especially our own Larry Mueller, who will be returning later this week. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News.